The following preview is of a graphic audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
I am the king who was.
Graphic Audio presents.
There have been major incidents at dozens of sites across the globe.
DC Comics.
A lot of deaths, a lot of damage.
The king who will be.
Justice League of America.
He's drawing his power from the planet itself.
Batman.
I am.
His aim is to destroy the world.
The Stone King.
What in the world could be strong enough to overcome?
Can we launch a full-scale assault?
Come on, Wally, you can do this!
No, I won't allow it. I can't allow it.
It's impossible to keep flying. I'm going down.
There's no way. I'm gonna make it in time.
Oh! The cycle is ending. Make peace with your gods. Tonight, every last one of you will die.
Copyright DC Comics 2008. The Justice League of America, Batman, and all related names, characters, and elements are trademarks of DC Comics 2008. All rights reserved.
And now, for our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's Blood Bond. By William W. Johnstone with J.A. Johnstone. Narrated by Thomas Penny. With performances by Dylan Lynch, James Lewis, Christopher Graybill, Kate Torrey, Stephen Carpenter, Sonny Lasky, Kate Torrey, Tim Carlin, Karen Carbone, James Konacek, Colleen Delaney, Andy Clements, Richard Rowan, David Coyne, Nanette Savard, Ken Jackson, Michael Glenn, Michael John Casey, and Mort Shelby. Blood Bond number 12, Ride for Vengeance.
The school in Sweet Apple, Texas, not far from the Rio Grande, wasn't serving its usual function tonight. The benches and desks had been moved to create a large open space in the middle of the floor, and dancing couples filled that space. Folks in Sweet Apple were having a high old time. Matt Bodine leaned against one of the walls of the schoolroom.
All these pretty gals, not one of them wants to dance with me.
Stop complaining. We're working, remember?
Sam was referring to their present employment as deputies, under the now famous Marshal Seymour Standish. It was a long story involving owl hoots, Mexican revolutionaries, a fancy name for bandidos, and a train car full of U.S. Army rifles. Much powder had been burned. The air in Sweet Apple's main street had been full of gun smoke and hot lead. Blood had been spilled, including a mite that belonged to Matt Bodine. But in the weeks since that big ruckus, things had been fairly peaceful in the town. Matt and Sam knew that wouldn't last. It never did. Tonight, they were dressed a little fancier than usual for the dance. Matt in a brown tweed suit instead of his usual jeans and blue bib front shirt. Sam in dark gray wool instead of his buckskins. They both wore boiled white shirts and string ties. Matt pulled at his collar and grimaced in discomfort and distaste.
Damn thing feels like a noose. This must be what it's like to get strung up.
Are you going to complain about everything tonight?
I might.
Matt's eyes followed the slender, graceful, red-headed form of Jessie Colton as she danced with one of the men from Sweet Apple.
Oh, I understand now. You're mad because you haven't gotten to dance with Jesse yet.
I saw you eyeing Sandy Paxton. Don't tell me you wouldn't rather be out there with her instead of standing here holding up this damn wall.
We're doing more than that. We're keeping an eye on the men from the Double C and Pax.
Matt had to admit that those cowboys did need to be kept an eye on. Like the men who rode for all the other spreads in the area, the hands from the Double C and Pax ranches had come into Sweet Apple for the dance. They all knew that hostilities had to be put aside at the door. That was the plan, anyway. Whether or not it worked might be another story entirely. At one time, Pax and Double C had been one vast ranch, owned by cousins Esau Paxton and Shadrach Colton. Matt and Sam knew that much, but they had no idea why. Somewhere along the way, the spread had been broken in two, and Paxton and Colton had become bitter enemies. That was the case, though, and the feud was still going on. So far tonight, the men from Pax and Double C hadn't done any more than eye each other suspiciously. Matt and Sam hoped it would stay that way. Marshall Standish went by them, dancing with Magdalena Elena Luisa Orion, the pretty little half-Mexican, half-Irish schoolmarm. Maggie Orion had a big smile on her face. She was sweet on Seymour, and the feeling was mutual. Seymour glanced over Maggie's shoulder at Matt and Sam, who each gave him a curt nod, signifying that everything was all right so far. Seymour looked both relieved and happy. His face was flushed from the exertion of dancing, but it wasn't as noticeable as it would have been a month or so earlier when he'd first arrived in Sweet Apple from Trenton, New Jersey. He'd been a salesman then for the Standish Dry Goods Company, not a lawman. He'd also been pale as bread dough and just about as courageous. In fact, he'd been known for a time as the most cowardly man in the West, a tag slapped on him by the local newspaper editor. Nobody thought of him that way anymore, not after he'd stood up to the fierce outlaw Deuce Mallory and Mallory's bloodthirsty gang, as well as the vicious bandits led by Diego Alcazario. Seymour was still slender and a little pale, although he was starting to tan a little, but he carried himself with more confidence, and with tutoring from Matt and Sam, he was getting better every day with the six-gun he now packed in a holster on his hip. A couple of well-fed, middle-aged gents sidled up to the Blood Brothers. Abner Mitchell was a local merchant and the mayor of Sweet Apple. J. Emerson Heathcote published the newspaper and served on the town council with Mitchell and some of the other businessmen.
It appears that everything's under control.
Matt supposed that Mitchell was just a natural-born politician. He'd probably launched into an oration for the first time when the midwife slapped him on the ass after birthing him.
I see that everyone from the Double C and Pax came into town tonight.
Of course they did. It's a dance. Everybody comes to a dance.
If there's trouble, perhaps in the future the ranches could alternate.
No offense, Mr. Heathcote, but you're getting ahead of yourself. Everybody knows the rules. No matter what happens out on the range, when you step into a dance, you leave all that behind.
Yes, yes, I know, but some of those young cowhands are pretty hot-headed.
If anything happens, we'll take care of it.
Seymour came up to Matt, Sam, Mayor Mitchell, and J. Emerson Heathcote. The marshal was out of breath and sweating a little. He had been wounded in the battle a couple of weeks earlier, too, and maybe he wasn't quite back up to his full strength yet.
My word, that young lady can dance.
You aren't complaining, though, are you, Marshal?
Not in the slightest.
Sitting this one out?
Yes. Maggie said she needed to catch her breath, and to tell the truth, so do I. I was glad to oblige her.
Oh, ho, ho, ho. Do I hear matrimonial bells in the offing? Should I save space on the front page of the paper for a wedding story?
Good Lord, no. Mr. Heathcote, I mean... That would be vastly premature. Perhaps someday, if Maggie and I mean, if Miss Orion and I continue to grow closer, I mean, if we decide that we want to...
Why don't you stop right there, Seymour? I reckon we all get your drift.
Good. I saw some of the men from the Double C going out the back door a few minutes ago.
Probably somebody's got a jug outside.
They'll guzzle down some of that who hit John and then be back inside.
I suspect that you're correct. The only reason I worried was because I saw Jeff Riley and some of the men from PAX follow them.
Matt stiffened. Jeff Riley was Esau Paxton's top horsebreaker, and he was one of those hotheads Heathcote had alluded to. He'd been involved in more than one scuffle with riders from the Double C. Matt supposed that all the jerking and jolting Riley's brain had taken while he was on the backs of those wild broncs might have something to do with the man's rash behavior.
Maybe we'd better go take a look, just to make sure nothing's brewing.
The back door, you said?
That's right. I'd better come with
you. That's all right.
We can handle this. It'd be better for you to keep an eye on things in here, Marshal.
Oh, of course. I'll stay in here while the two of you see what's going on outside.
The Blood Brothers didn't seem to hurry as they crossed the room, skirting around the dancers. But there wasn't a wasted movement between them, and they arrived at the rear door pretty quickly. Not quite quickly enough, though. Matt and Sam stepped outside. The moon and the glow of the lamplight that came through the windows of the school building provided enough light for them to be able to see the two compact groups of men facing each other. The cowboys crouched, their hands hovering over the butts of their guns as they stood ready to hook and draw. Matt's eyes took in the scene instantly, and he reacted just as fast. He saw Jeff Riley standing out in front of one group, while facing him was Tom Danks, one of the Double C's top hands, and just as big a hothead as Riley. Without thinking about what he was doing, Matt launched himself in a dive from the little porch at the rear of the schoolhouse. Matt tackled Riley and drove the Bronc Buster off his feet.
Hold it, Danks! Get your hand away from that gun!
Riley pushed himself up.
What the hell? Why'd you jump me like that, Bodine?
You and Danks were about to draw on each other, weren't you?
What if we were? That's our business, ain't it?
Not tonight. Not right outside a schoolhouse where there's a dance going on. There are a lot of innocent folks in there, Riley. Some of them could have gotten hurt if lead started to fly out here.
Riley, who was a wiry man with a lean, fox-like face, sneered at him.
For a gunslinger, you're mighty concerned about innocent folks getting hurt. You always think about that every time you slap leather, Bodine?
Not always. Sometimes there just isn't enough time for that. But I don't go out of my way to endanger anybody either.
Two of you strutting around town all high and mighty, you make me sick. You ain't even real deputies. You got no right to tell me what to do.
Tom Danks spoke up.
Bodine, why don't you go get the marshal? I want Riley arrested.
Arrested? For what?
Slander. He called Shad Colton a rustler.
That's what he is.
Nobody's going to get arrested for slander. Now, why don't all of you either go back inside and enjoy the dance, or else get your horses and go home? Either way, there's not going to be any gunfight out here tonight.
I'm sure as hell not taking any orders from a filthy redskin. I don't care if you are wearing white man's clothes, ain't
you? Shut up. You've done all the dancing you're gonna do tonight. Get the hell out of my sight, Riley.
What are you gonna do if I don't? I'm not gonna draw on you, Bodine. I know you'd kill me. So how are you gonna make me leave?
Oh, the hell with it.
The other cowboys from PAX would have stood with Riley in a fight, but that didn't mean they liked him. And none of them wanted to go up against Matt Bodine either.
Somebody put him on his horse and take him back out to PAX. When he wakes up, tell him not to come back to town until he's sober and cool-headed.
A couple of cowboys moved to do as Matt said.
Like I told you. Either go back into the dance or go home. But the trouble is over. Understand?
Both groups broke up, some of the men returning to the schoolhouse, others drifting off into the night. Matt joined Sam on the porch. Sam still held his revolver, but he had lowered it to his side.
Think the ones who left will start taking pot shots at each other in the dark?
I don't reckon that's likely. Looked like Riley and Danks were the ones who were stirring things up.
I wonder what that business about Shad Colton being a rustler was all about.
Just a drunk mouthing off, I'd say. Riley was trying to get under Dank's skin.
Yeah, I guess.
Matt and Sam went back inside, where Seymour hurried over to them right away.
What happened? People are saying that there was almost a gunfight, and there was something about punches being thrown.
Punch. There was only one punch, and I threw it.
You were right to worry, Seymour. A couple of men from the Double C and PAX were about to slap leather. And if they had, the rest of both sides would have joined in. It could have been pretty bloody.
But you stopped them.
Yeah.
This time. Somebody ought to have a talk with Colton and Paxson and see if they can't be convinced to patch up their differences and put an end to this feud.
I agree, but I couldn't do that. I haven't been here long enough. Neither of those men would listen to me.
Yeah, you're probably right. Anyway, I've heard about these Texas feuds. Usually the only thing that ever ends them is when one side is wiped out.
My God. That would require wholesale slaughter.
Yeah, that's about the size of it.
Matt Bodine's comment was still on Seymour's mind as he walked Maggie Orion back to her house after the dance was over.
Is that really the way it is here in Texas? One family commits mass murder on another family?
Well, they sort of commit mass murder on each other. That's why they call it a feud.
I've learned a lot about the West in the relatively short time I've been here, and there's a great deal I like about it. But I'm not sure if I'll ever become accustomed to the cheapness of human life on the frontier.
It's only some of the people who feel that way, Seymour. We're not all like that. I wish there never had to be any violence at all. I worry about you being the marshal. Something could happen to you.
I'll be fine. I'm learning all the time how to handle the job. And as long as I have Matt and Sam around to help me.
But that's just it. Mr. Bodine and Mr. Two Wolves won't be around Sweet Apple forever. They're drifters, Seymour. You'll wake up one morning and they'll be gone.
I know. Matt warned me that they were violin-footed, I believe was his word. Although I'm not quite sure I understand the derivation of it.
Fiddle-footed, Seymour. I'm sure he said fiddle-footed.
Oh, yes, I believe he did. I suppose that makes a bit more sense. But at any rate, I know that the time will come when I have to maintain law and order in Sweet Apple by myself. I'm confident that by then I'll be up to the job.
I hope that's true, Seymour. You don't know how much I hope that's true.
Her words made his heart swell. During his time in Texas, he had grown very fond of Miss Magdalena Elena Louisa Orion. She was smart and pretty and very sweet. She was devoted to her job of educating the town's youngsters, often whether they wanted to be educated or not, and Seymour found that quite admirable.
You know, I'm sure there are people back east who are prone to violence, too.
Not like there are out here. Take the Coltons and the Paxtons. These are two of the leading families in the entire area. They own successful ranches. Their children are educated. They're not lowbred hooligans. And yet if hostilities between them continue to escalate, there's a good chance that soon they'll be shooting at each other. Something like that would never happen back in New Jersey. People are simply too civilized there to resort to such tactics.
Maybe you're right, Seymour.
Meanwhile, back in New Jersey, Cornelia Standish sat behind the big desk in his office in the building that housed the Standish Dry Goods Company and intently regarded the three men who stood before him. Warren Welch was a fresh-faced young man with curly brown hair and a friendly expression. You had to look at his cold, snake-like eyes to know what sort of man he really was. Daniel McCracken was a red-headed, belligerent Irishman. Standish didn't fully trust him, but he was said to be good at his job. Ed Stover was the tallest and the oldest of the three, a broad-shouldered man with a mostly bald head and a fringe of gray hair under his pushed-back derby. All three men were associates of the late Wilford Grant, who had been hired by Standish to do a particular job and who had failed miserably. Grant and his partner Spike Morelli had paid for that failure with their lives. But that didn't help Standish. He was still faced with the same problem. McCracken pushed his jaw out.
I ain't sure I'm caring for the job you've proposed, Mr. Standish. Who in his right mind is going to believe that we're dry goods salesmen?
No one will question it because I'll be with you.
Stover scratched at his bald pate with a blunt finger.
I made that mistake once already when I trusted Grant and Morelli. This time I'm going to make sure that nephew of mine is out of the way.
It was bad enough that Seymour owned half of the Standish Dry Goods Company, which had been built into a going concern by Cornelius and his brother, Seymour's late father. Half of the profits that should have belonged to Cornelius now went into Seymour's bank account, even though he was no longer here in New Jersey and had resigned his position as a salesman for the company. One circumstance that was compelling Standish to take action against Seymour was the company's increasing ties to the criminal element in New Jersey and New York. One way to increase business was to make it difficult for your competitors to be successful. If it took beating up delivery men or artificially inflating freight rates for everyone else or even seeing to it that a fire accidentally broke out at a rival company's warehouse, well, that was just business. A smart man didn't draw the line at whatever tactics were necessary. The only line that mattered was the one that showed a profit or loss in a ledger. But Seymour, soft, gullible, innocent Seymour, wouldn't understand that. Therefore, something had to be done about him. Cornelius had thought that dispatching him to Sweet Apple, Texas would take care of that. The place had a reputation for being one of the most dangerous settlements on the frontier. Standish had been certain that Seymour wouldn't last a week there before one of the local gunmen shot him. That had almost happened, in fact, but somehow Seymour had not only survived, but thrived. Those idiots had even made him the town marshal, and now he was regarded as some sort of hero.
Until I've had a chance to look the situation over and decide on the best plan of action, the three of you will pretend to be salesmen who will be working the western part of Texas for the company. You shouldn't have to actually sell anything, because I don't expect it to take very long to accomplish our real goal. Now, are all of you in or not?
Welch, McCracken, and Stover exchanged glances. They were brutal, uneducated men, but they were experienced enough to know that if they backed out now, after Standish had revealed his plans to them, they would be putting their own lives in danger.
We're in.
Welch jerked his head in a curt nod. The other two nodded as well.
Very well. We'll be leaving for Texas on the 11 o'clock train tomorrow morning.
With their business concluded, the three men left. When they were gone, Rebecca Jimerson came in from the outer office. A beautiful young woman with sleek, honey-blonde hair, Rebecca was Standish's secretary and his mistress.
Did they agree?
Of course. They'll be well paid and they know it. I'll need you to go down to the train station and purchase 4 tickets on the 11 o'clock westbound.
Why don't I purchase 5 tickets and make 2 of them for a sleeper?
You want to go?
I've never been to Texas. In fact, I've never seen anything west of New Jersey.
From everything I've heard, Texas is a horrible place. You wouldn't like it.
I was thinking that when your business was done there, we might go on to San Francisco for a week. Wouldn't you like to spend a week in San Francisco with me, Cornelius?
I suppose it would be all right. The office can get along without both of us for a while.
Of course it can.
Go lock the door.
Thank you, Cornelius.
Jessica Colton knew she made an appealing picture as she rode along with the wind making her long red hair stream out behind her head. She wore trousers and a man's shirt and rode astride, even though she knew that scandalized her mother, Carolyn. A side saddle was fine for cantering through the city park back east. Jessie had done that more than once. But for pure enjoyment, there was nothing like galloping over the West Texas hills and plains, and that required some real riding. She had ridden out today, the day after the dance in Sweet Apple, to meet Sandy Paxton at the creek that formed part of the boundary between the Double C and Pax ranches. Her father had tried to discourage her from spending so much time with Sandy, but Chad Colton knew better than to forbid his strong-willed daughter from doing anything. That would just make Jessie even more determined to do it. She knew from things Sandy had told her that her father, Esau Paxton, was the same way. Esau didn't like the two of them being friends, but it was much too late to do anything about that now. Jessie and Sandy had been close companions ever since childhood. They had grown up together, more like sisters than second cousins, and gone away to school together. It was while they were back east that the rift had developed between their families. Neither young woman knew what had caused it, but whatever it was, they didn't see any reason why it should keep them from being friends. Jessie came in sight of the creek, which ran roughly north and south, rising in the rugged hills and meandering some 20 miles before finally running into the Rio Grande. Pax lay to the east of the stream, Double C to the west. Both spreads extended on into the hills, past the spring where the creek bubbled to life, and up there the boundary was less well defined. That didn't matter much, because all the good graze was down here along the creek. The stream's banks were dotted with scrubby cottonwood and mesquite trees, as well as the occasional desert willow or oak. Sandy hadn't gotten there yet. They had agreed to meet here this morning so they could talk about everything that had happened at the dance the night before. Sandy would want to talk about Sam Two Wolves, Jesse thought with a smile. Sandy thought Sam was just about the handsomest man she had ever seen. Jesse had to admit that Sam was a good-looking man, but Matt Bodine was better-looking, she thought. She and Sandy had met Matt and Sam at the train station in Marfa when the young women were returning to Sweetapple from school. There'd been some trouble there, and two hard cases who had been bothering Jesse and Sandy had made the mistake of drawing on the Blood Brothers when Matt and Sam intervened on their behalf. Those fools had wound up lying dead on the platform. It might have turned out like that anyway, since both of the girls had been packing iron and knew how to shoot. That fancy Eastern school had taught them quite a bit, true enough, but it hadn't made them something they weren't. They were still West Texas gals, through and through. The drumming of hoofbeats made her look up. She spotted Sandy on the other side of the creek, riding toward her. And something was wrong, too, Jesse realized, as Sandy came closer. Her friend had a worried look on her face.
What's wrong, Sandy?
Pa fired Jeff Riley this morning.
Good riddance, I'd say. I know he was a good bronc buster, but I never liked him. I saw the way he looked at you sometimes in town when you didn't know he was watching you.
I knew it. I just didn't let it bother me all that much. Hell, girl, men have been looking at both of us like that for quite a while now.
Yeah, I know. Sometimes I don't mind, depending on who's doing the looking.
I don't trust Riley. He's liable to try to get even with Pa.
Why'd your father fire him? Because of that ruckus in town last night?
That's right. Everybody had strict orders not to cause any trouble no matter what.
Same was true for the Double C Riders. My Pa gave Tom Danks a good old-fashioned chewing out this morning, since it was Tom that Riley almost drew on, but he didn't fire him.
Well, Riley cussed my father. I thought for a second Pa was going to have him horsewhipped and then thrown off the ranch, but Riley left on his own.
I guess he had a right to be mad. He got knocked out by Matt Bodine last night and then lost his job this morning.
He'd better be glad he didn't try to draw on Matt or Sam. If he had, he'd be dead now.
Well, there's nothing we can do about Riley. And anyway, your Pa can take care of himself. Besides, there's something else that's bothering me.
What's that?
How come that blasted Matt Bodine and Sam Two Wolves didn't ask us to dance last night? What's wrong with them?
Some girls would be asking what was wrong with themselves if a couple of boys they liked didn't ask them to dance.
There's nothing wrong with us, and you know it.
I reckon they must have thought they shouldn't be dancing since they were there to help the marshal.
Marshal Standish danced with that little schoolmarm. I saw him.
Yeah, but Matt and Sam didn't dance with anybody. At least not that I saw.
Well, Matt Bodine just missed his chance. That's all I've got to say.
Yeah, sure. If he asks you next time there's a social, you'll fall all over yourself saying yes, Jesse.
I will not. Why, Matt Bodine can go climb a stump as far as I care.
Half a dozen riders were coming toward them, trailed by a wagon carrying posts, rolls of wire, and several more cowboys.
Oh, Lord. What's Pa up to now?
Shadrach Colton was the source of the red hair that Jesse and her younger brothers and sisters had inherited, although Colton's still thick hair was shot through with gray. He had the burly build and rugged face of a man who had worked outdoors and worked hard most of his life. As he and the other riders came up to the creek, he reined in and looked at his daughter and Sandy with hard, pale blue eyes.
Miss Paxton?
Hello, Uncle Shad.
Even though Colton wasn't really her uncle, as a child, she had referred to him that way, just as Jesse had called Sandy's father Uncle Esau.
You'd better ride on back home now.
Sandy doesn't have to go if she doesn't want to.
It's all right. I'm on Double C range on this side of the creek after all.
It ain't that, Sandy. You're welcome over here anytime. You know that. So's your ma.
What about Royce and Dave?
Sandy referred to her twin brothers, who were 2 years younger than her.
They stand with your pa, I reckon. Couldn't be any other way with Esau raising them.
What are you going to do? What are all those posts and wire for?
Don't you worry about that. Get on back home now.
Not until you tell me what this is all about. You always said you'd never have any truck with that devil wire you called it. This is open range country. Always has been and always will be.
I wish it was still that way, but the time's come to put up a fence.
Where? The creek's always been the boundary line between the two ranches.
Nope. According to the papers filed at the county seat, the boundary is the east bank of the creek, and then a line due north from the spring where it rises.
You're going to put a fence on the other side of the creek?
On my father's land?
Hack's range stops where the creek starts. That's where the fence is gonna go.
But then our cattle can't get to it. What'll they do for water?
You've got a creek on your range.
But it dries up half the year. It's almost dry now. Our stock has always used this creek.
Not anymore.
Pa, this ain't right.
Good Lord, gal, what kind of talk is that? Didn't I send you to school so you could learn how to talk like a proper lady?
All right, then. Father, this isn't right. It isn't proper behavior. And it certainly isn't fair to Mr. Paxson. It's a bunch of damn bullshit's what it is.
Get. Go on home before I forget that you're damn near Grodin. Powder you like a spoiled brat.
I'd like to see you try it.
Colton turned toward the hands who had accompanied him.
Get to work! I want a good stretch of that fence up before sundown today!
Colton swung his horse toward Sandy again.
Sandy gal, you got to go now. I'm sorry.
I'm going. But I don't believe you're really sorry or you wouldn't be doing this. I'm going to see what my pa has to say about it. I can't believe he'd ever agree to this.
Sandy heeled her horse into motion and splashed back across the creek.
So long, Sandy.
The double C hands who had ridden out on the wagon hopped down, and the ones on horseback dismounted. They showed an obvious reluctance for working with a newfangled barbed wire, which had been introduced several years earlier but was still quite unpopular in Texas. The fact that Chad Colton would resort to using the devil wire was a sign of just how deep his ill feelings toward Esau Paxton really ran. Jesse watched in dismay as the cowboys began sinking posts along the far bank of the creek and stringing wire between them. Chad Colton dismounted and worked alongside them. He had never been the sort of hombre to ask his men to do anything he wouldn't do himself, which was one reason they felt such fierce loyalty to him. The work was slow and hard, and it hadn't progressed very far by late morning. That was when Jesse spotted the dust cloud in the distance to the east, on Pack's range.
Rider's coming, Pa.
Colton lowered the fence post he was holding and looked where Jesse was pointing.
Damn.
Colton took off the work gloves he had donned earlier. Then he came over to where Jesse still sat on her horse under the cottonwoods and put a hand on the animal's shoulder.
Jesse, I mean it. I want you to go home. There's liable to be some trouble, and I don't want you anywhere around here.
Gun trouble, you mean?
I don't reckon that'll...
You know better, Pa.
I don't reckon it'll come to that. But if it does, I want you safe, girl.
Jesse reached for the butt of the Winchester that stuck up from the sheath strapped to her saddle. She never went riding without a rifle.
I'm a Colton, too.
Jesse, what if Sandy's with him?
It was too late to ponder what her father had said. The riders swept up on the other side of the creek and reined in. The air was thick with dust, and a sense that all hell was about to break loose. During Sandy Paxton's ride back to the headquarters of her father's ranch, she had pondered long and hard about whether or not she ought to tell him about what was going on at the creek. When Sandy reached Pax, she spotted her father walking out of one of the barns with a couple of ranch hands, including Gil Cochran, the foreman. A few yards away, Sandy's brothers, Royce and Dave, perched on the top rail of a corral fence, watching as one of the cowboys tried to break a Mustang. Pax would miss the services of Jeff Riley, who had been a top-notch bronc buster, despite the fact that he wasn't very pleasant to be around. Esau Paxton wouldn't abide a man who couldn't, or wouldn't, follow orders, though. Esau Paxton knew his oldest child well enough to realize that something was bothering her.
What's wrong, Sandy?
Shag Colton's fixing to fence off the creek.
Fence off the... what creek? Not the one between his place and ours.
That's right.
Dadgummit, he can't do that. That creek belongs to both of us. We've always both used it as long as the spreads have been split up.
I know, but he says it's his and he's going to put up a fence along the east bank.
You mean barbed wire?
Yeah, he's got a wagon full of posts and rolls of wire out there.
Where exactly?
That spot between Rattlesnake Ridge and the Prairie Dog Town, where Jesse and I always meet.
I know the place. We'll just see about that.
Paxton turned to Cochran, his foreman.
Gil, round up half a dozen of the boys. We're riding out.
Sure thing, boss. Should I tell them to bring along plenty of ammunition?
Damned right you should.
Pa, Uncle Shad's got 8 or 10 men out there with him. If you go storming out there with a burr under your saddle, there's liable to be a fight.
What do you expect me to do? Our cattle need that creek for water.
I know, but maybe you should go to town and let your lawyer handle this. In school, we learned that it's better to trust the legal system.
Back east, maybe. Not out here.
Paxton turned and stalked toward the house.
I'll get my rifle.
Pa!
Sandy quickly galloped her horse over to the front porch.
Sandra, what's going on? What's your father so upset about?
Quickly, Sandy filled her mother in on what was happening out at the creek. Julia's face grew more and more worried as she listened. Paxton came out of the house carrying a rifle. Julia turned to him and reached out to stop him with a hand on his arm.
Esau, where do you think you're going?
To set that damn Shad Colton straight. He can't get away with such high-handed behavior.
Why not let the law handle...
Lord, woman, you're as bad as your daughter.
Without looking back, Paxton went down the steps and headed toward the barn, where several cowboys were already leading out saddled horses. Sandy watched, her alarm growing, as her brothers hurried over to their father and spoke to him. Paxton jerked his head in a nod and gestured toward the horses.
Oh, dear Lord, he's taking the boys with him.
Can't you do anything to stop this, Ma?
When your father gets all head up like this, there's no stopping him. He won't listen to me or anybody else. He's always been that way.
As the two women watched, the men mounted up and galloped out of the ranch yard, heading west toward the creek. Dust hung in the air from their leave-taking.
Can you ride to town?
Of course.
Then get there as fast as you can and tell the marshal what's happening. Maybe he can do something about it.
Sandy wasn't sure about Marshal Seymour Standish being able to handle this situation, but she had an idea of two other men that might be able to. Sandy flung herself back in the saddle and galloped hell for leather toward Sweet Apple, hoping against hope that she could find Matt Bodine and Sam Two Wolves. Sandy wasn't with the group from PAX, Jesse saw to her great relief, but Sandy's father, Esau, was there, along with the twins, Royce and Dave. All of them looked tense and angry, as did the 7 cowboys who were with them. The odds were just about even between the two bunches.
What the hell you think you're doing, Colton?
Only what I have a legal right to do. I'm fencing the boundary between your land and mine, Paxton.
The creek is the boundary.
Not according to the deeds that were drawn up when the CP was divided.
The ranch that had been jointly owned by both men had been called the CP for Colton and Paxton.
The deeds say that the boundary line is the east bank of the creek. You can go to the county seat and look them up if you don't believe me.
That can't be. I looked that paperwork over before I signed the agreements. That's not what it said.
Go see for yourself.
It doesn't matter. This is Texas, for God's sake. Nobody fences off cattle from water, no matter what it says on some damn pieces of paper.
It's true that I've been generous and let your cows drink from this creek, Paxton, but it's my creek, and I've decided that I need all the water from it. This is the only dependable water supply on the Double C, after all.
It's the only dependable water supply on PAX, too.
You've got another creek.
One that's not worth a damn.
That's not my problem.
It will be when my men tear that fence down.
The first PAX man who lays a hand on this fence will get a bullet in his mangy eye.
Paxton looked at his two twin sons.
You boys get on back to the ranch.
But, Pa!
Do what I tell you, blast it. You shouldn't have come out here in the first place.
Jesse, please ride on back home now.
And what do I tell Mama when she asks me where you are? That you're out here getting yourself shot full of holes over a damned fence?
Jesse! I warn you, gal, I'm not going to take much more talk like that from you.
Taking Jesse by surprise, Colton grabbed the reins of her horse from her and hauled the animal's head around.
Pa, what are you...
Yeah!
The reins were trailing, and when Jesse lunged to grab them, she missed on the first couple of tries.
Oh!
You son of a bitch!
Daddy, no!
Matt and Sam had taken rooms in Sweet Apple's only boarding house, which was run by a hatchet-faced widow named Ferguson. The Blood Brothers were just about to sit down to lunch in the house's dining room, along with some of the other boarders, when Sandy Paxton hurried in with a worried expression on her face. Seymour came in behind her, looking a mite worried himself.
Thank goodness. Marshal Standish told me I'd probably find you here.
What's wrong, Sandy?
My father and Jesse's father. trouble at the creek between our ranches.
Miss Paxton seems to think there may be shooting.
Uncle Shad's trying to fence off the creek.
Devil wire?
Yes.
Miss Paxton thought you two might be able to do something to stop her father and Mr. Colton from killing each other. I'll come with you.
No offense, Seymour, but you don't have any authority out there.
Neither do you. Yeah, but we don't have a marshal's job to lose. We're just a couple of saddle tramps, remember? Come on, Sam, let's ride.
Thank you.
Seymour followed Matt and Sam outside as they went to the stable behind the boarding house where their horses were.
I'm coming with you.
You've got a job to do here in town. The citizens of Sweet Apple are counting on you to keep the peace.
Besides, it'll be better if you don't take sides in this fight. Men from PAX and the Double C ride into the settlement all the time, and it's best that none of them think you're one of the enemy. They'll be more likely to behave themselves that way.
Well, yes, I suppose I can see that. Anyway, what sort of trouble could I handle that Matt Bodine and Sam Two Wolves couldn't? Yeah!
Matt and Sam were able to make good time, but still, it was a good 5 miles from the settlement to the creek, and it took a while to get there. With every minute that passed, Matt and Sam worried that a gun battle might have already broken out. They were about a half mile from the creek when they heard the first signs of trouble.
Damn it!
And it meant they were too late to stop this range war before it started. A couple of minutes later, Matt and Sam came in sight of the line of trees that marked the course of the creek. They were on the western side of the stream, so they couldn't see very well what was going on to the east. The cottonwoods and mesquite screened off that part of the view. But it was obvious that the continuing gunfire came from over there. Clouds of smoke rose into the air, indicating that a lot of powder was being burned. Of course, Matt and Sam already knew that from the constant crashing of shots. Movement on this side of the creek caught their attention. A rider careened at top speed across the flats. The long red hair blowing in the wind told Matt that the person in the saddle of that madly galloping horse was Jesse Colton.
That horse is a runaway.
I know. Ha!
Matt knew he was leaving Sam to deal with the fight between the forces from the Colton and Paxton ranches, at least for the time being, but he couldn't help it. If that runaway horse stepped in a hole and tripped, or didn't see a gully in time to avoid it, Jesse's life would be in definite danger. Matt had to help her if he could. Matt turned his horse more so that he was riding in the same direction as Jesse. Leaning forward over the stallion's neck, he urged the gray on. Gradually, the distance between Matt and Jesse began to shrink. He drew alongside her and reached over, balancing precariously in his saddle and trusting to his mount to maintain a steady pace. His fingers brushed the dangling reins. Matt strained forward and closed his hands around the lines. He straightened in the saddle and hauled back on them.
Thanks. I'm all right. You've got to stop them before they all kill each other.
I reckon Sam's working on that already. But I'll go see if I can give him a hand, too.
When Matt had peeled off to go to Jesse's rescue, Sam had continued on toward the creek at a cautious walk. He rode into the trees along the western bank of the stream and swung down from the saddle. Sam pulled his Winchester from the saddle boot as he did so. Close to a dozen men were sprawled on their bellies along the eastern bank, firing at a low hummock of ground about 100 yards away. The slight rise was 40 or 50 feet long. Puffs of gun smoke rose from the grassy crest. Sam spotted the burly figure of Shad Colton among the men lying along the creek bank. It was pretty easy to figure out what had happened. When the battle had broken out, Colton and his men had dug in here, using the bank for cover, while Paxton and his men had retreated and taken shelter behind that hummock. Neither force was in a particularly good position, and judging from the smoke Sam saw along the rise, they were about equal in numbers. It was a standoff. They could keep this up as long as the ammunition held out. But Sam knew that if they kept it up, someone was going to get killed. So he did the only thing he could think to do. He raised his Winchester and drew a bead on Shad Colton's big 10-gallon hat.
Hold your fire! Don't move! Hold your fire, or I'll drill your boss next time, not his hat.
Sam risked a glance and saw Matt approaching at a gallop. That had to mean Jesse was all right.
Matt! Bring in the Paxton bunch!
Matt waved to show that he understood and turned his horse to circle around the spot where Sam had taken Colton's men prisoner. The guns along the crest of the rise had fallen silent, too, in response to the double C ceasing fire.
What do you want, Two Wolves?
For you to show a little common sense, Colton! Going to war against Paxton's not going to solve anything!
Tell that to Paxton! He's the one who started the ball, dammit! One of his men fired the first shot!
Meanwhile, Matt pulled out his bandana and tied it to the end of his rifle barrel. He saw one of Paxton's cowboys holding their horses about 200 yards behind the hummock. Paxton and his men had stopped shooting, and they held their fire as Matt approached. They turned so that they could cover him, though, and he felt distinctly uncomfortable with nearly a dozen rifles and six guns pointing at him. Several of the men had bloodstains on their clothing, but none of them seemed to be hurt badly.
Bodine, what are you doing here?
Trying to keep you idiots from killing each other. Your daughter rode in a sweet apple and told us what was going on out here.
You've got no authority except in the settlement, and you're not even real deputies there. What the hell makes you think you can tell us what to do?
The fact that I got this rifle pointed at you, Paxton.
You pull that trigger and you'll be full of lead a second later.
More than likely. But you'll be dead before me.
Hold your fire, man. Put your guns down. What do you want from us?
Go on back over to the creek and talk to Colton. Just you. Your men stay here.
That bastard's liable to shoot me. He already tried to. He and his men started this fight, not us.
I don't care who started it. And Colton's not going to shoot anybody, because my blood brother Sam Two Wolves is holding a gun on him right now. Get it through your head, Paxton. This fight's over.
Have Colton come out of the trees and meet me halfway. Then maybe I'll talk to him. Although it's not going to do a damn bit of good. That hard-headed son of a bitch won't listen to reason. He never would.
Sam! Send Colton out! Paxton's going to come talk to him. Alone!
Matt didn't know if Colton would agree to that, but a moment later, the red-headed rancher appeared, stalking forward. With a jerk of the rifle barrel, Matt indicated that Paxton should go out and meet him. Paxton walked over the top of the hummock and started toward Colton. A muscle in his jaw was jumping from the strain of how hard his teeth were clamped together. Matt followed Paxton on horseback. Colton and Paxton stopped when about 10 feet still separated them.
I don't know why these two crazy hellions wanted us to talk to each other. I don't have anything to say to you, Paxton.
And I wouldn't want to listen to it if you did.
Then talk to me. What in blazes is this ruckus all about?
This bastard plans to fence off my cattle from that creek.
It's my creek. I got every right to put up a fence if I want to.
The creek belongs to both of us. That's the way we split it up.
Not according to the paperwork at the county seat. The boundary line is on this side of the creek. That means all the water belongs to me.
Out here in the frontier, folks share water when they can. It's just the way things are done.
My cows need it.
So do mine. And no legal shenanigans are going to keep them from it.
Are you accusing me of being crooked?
You must be trying to pull a fast one with those papers you keep talking about. I never would have signed over full ownership of that creek to you, and you know it.
What do those documents at the county seat say exactly?
They say that the boundaries of the Pax Ranch run from the Big Turtle Draw on the east to Garford Creek on the west.
Colton pointed to the tree-lined stream.
That's Garford Creek, although folks don't hardly ever use the name.
That the way you remember it, Paxton?
Yeah, but that doesn't say that my range ends on this side of the creek. It says it runs all the way to the creek.
Right. Not to the midpoint of the creek. To the creek.
Will you stop saying that? You know damned well what it means. It means we both own the creek.
That ain't what it says, so that ain't what it means.
I've been watering my cows there for years. You never claimed I didn't have any right to the water.
Didn't care till now. Now I do.
You son of a... I never thought you'd stoop so low, you snake-blooded bastard.
Bluster all you want. It don't change nothing.
Listen to me, Paxton. It sounds like Colton's got the law on his side. Maybe that wasn't the way you intended for the deeds to read, and maybe nobody ever thought about the way they could be applied, but Colton's within his legal rights.
You're not a lawyer, Bodine. You're just a damned gunslinger.
If you want to fight Colton's claim in court, you go right ahead. I don't give a damn one way or the other about that. Just like I don't care who owns that creek. But your daughters don't want you two old pelicans filling each other with lead. And I like to oblige the ladies whenever I can. So for today, Both of you turn around and go home.
I got a fence to put up.
Not today. Let it go. Go home and cool off. See whatever bullet creases your men got in this little dust-up get taken care of. And for the rest of the day, damn it, try not to kill each other.
The two cattlemen glared at each other for a long moment.
I'll sue you.
Go ahead. See if that keeps me from putting up my fence.
Oh, it will. It will. You can't win, Colton. You can't deny water to thirsty cows and get away with it.
Well, are you two leaving or what?
What if we don't?
Then you'll have to fight me and Sam.
2 men against 20.
Oh, you mean you'd join forces?
Hell no, I mean... Oh, hell, I don't know what I mean. I'll be back tomorrow to put up that fence.
And I'll be in court this afternoon to stop you.
If you're going to court, then I can go to court too, damn you.
I reckon I'll see you there then.
Paxton turned on his heel and stalked off, heading back to his men. Colton did the same. Sam rode out to join Matt as both groups mounted up and got ready to ride out. Colton's men left the posts they had already put in place, but the wagon carrying the rest of the posts and the rolls of barbed wire rolled along after the riders as they headed for Double C headquarters. Paxton and his men rode east toward the Pax Ranch house.
Well, that was mighty damn close to being a massacre.
Them or us?
I'm not sure. Wouldn't want it either way. I heard Colton telling his men that Paxton is going to take him to court.
Yep. From what I heard, Colton's got the law on his side, but that doesn't always mean much.
At least they're not shooting at each other. That's something to be thankful for.
Sam pointed to a lone rider.
Here comes Jesse.
I'm not sure how you did it, but thank you, Matt. And you too, Sam. I thought for sure they were going to kill each other.
It could happen yet. I hate to say it, but I'm afraid this war between your paw and Esau Paxton isn't over yet. Not by a long shot.
There were no lawyers practicing in Sweet Apple, since there was no court there. All legal business was conducted in Marfa, the county seat located some 20 miles to the east of Sweet Apple. So for several days, Shadrach Colton and Esau Paxton were kept busy traveling back and forth between the settlements. Each man engaged the services of an attorney, and Paxton made good on his threat to file suit against his cousin and former partner. Matt and Sam didn't really care how that played out. What was important was that the two sides weren't shooting at each other, and peace reigned in Sweet Apple. Neither of the Blood Brothers expected that to last, however, and as usual, they were right. As town marshal, Seymour made a habit of being at the railroad station whenever a train rolled in, either eastbound or westbound. He considered it part of his duties to check out the passengers who got off in Sweet Apple. So he was standing on the platform, talking through the barred opening of the ticket window with the clerk, Harvey Bramlett, when the 2 o'clock westbound arrived. It was 2:18, according to the clock inside Harvey's little office, so the train was a little late, but not too much. The first passenger off the train, a white-haired man in late middle age, wore an expensive suit and hat and held himself stiffly. He carried a black, silver-headed walking stick in his left hand. When he reached the platform, he turned and extended his right hand to grasp the hand of the young woman who followed him down the steps. Seymour swallowed hard. His pulse pounded hard inside his head in pure surprise. Never in a million years would he have expected to see these two people in Sweet Apple. Seymour turned from the ticket counter and headed towards the train. The newcomers turned, saw him coming, and stopped in their tracks. They looked a little shocked, too.
Hello, Uncle Cornelius. Miss Jimerson.
Hello, Seymour. I don't mean to stare. It's just that...
You look like a character out of a dime novel.
Well... Yes, I, what are you doing here, Uncle Cornelius?
I'm here because of you.
Me?
That's right. I received the telegram you sent resigning your position with the company as a salesman. I must say that I was disappointed you would abandon your responsibilities like that, Seymour. I believe your late father, rest his soul, would have been disappointed too.
Well, I'm sorry, Uncle Cornelius. I just discovered that I'm not suited to be a dry goods salesman.
That's all you ever were, till you took on this ridiculous job. I suppose you're suited to be a Wild West lawman?
Well, as a matter of fact, I've done all right so far.
The newspapers call you the most cowardly man in the West.
Not anymore. Not since the battle with Deuce Mallory's gang and the raid by Diego El Cazario and his bandits. Mallory's dead, by the way. And El Cazario was sent limping back across the border into Mexico.
It doesn't matter now. What's important is that the company has been left high and dry by your rash actions, Seymour. And I've been forced to come out here myself to set things right.
You want me to come back to work for you?
Hardly. You've made your choice, and I suppose I have to accept that. No, I've brought someone to take your place. Three men, in fact, since Texas is such a vast territory.
Cornelius half turned and held out a hand, motioning forward three men who had climbed down from the train after him and Rebecca. They wore Eastern suits, too, although not as expensive and stylish as the one Standish sported.
These are my new salesmen, Warren Welch, Daniel McCracken, and Ed Stover.
Welch was a very clean-cut young man with a friendly smile. But as Seymour shook hands with him, he thought there was something wrong with Welch's eyes. It took a moment for him to realize that they reminded him of a lizard's eyes. Well, perhaps not a lizard exactly, but something similar. Daniel McCracken made no pretense of being friendly. He barely shook Seymour's hand and gave him a curt, sullen nod. The bear-like Stover wasn't very effusive either.
I wish you luck, all of you. If there's anything I can do to help you, I'd be glad to. I can introduce you to the merchants here in town. I know all of them now.
That would be fine, but later. We've all had a long journey and we're tired. I assume there's a hotel in this town.
Certainly there is. Of course, it's not what you'd call fancy. You'd have to go all the way to El Paso for that.
Take us there.
Seymour was relieved that the party from Trenton managed to check into the hotel without any comments about its Spartan character, at least by Eastern standards. He left them to clean up and recuperate from the long train ride. Several minutes after Seymour's departure, Cornelius barged into Rebecca's room without knocking. Of course, considering their relationship, propriety was hardly required. Still, he could have been more discreet, she thought.
Why were you playing up to that young fool? I saw the way you were looking at him.
I wasn't playing up to him. I was just being polite.
That's not what it looked like to me.
What? Are you jealous of your own nephew, Cornelius?
I have no reason to be jealous, do I?
None at all.
Seymour was still thinking about the unexpected appearance in Sweetapple of his uncle, Rebecca, and the three new dry goods salesmen as he went up the walk to the little house where Maggie lived. She had asked him to supper tonight, but he had suggested that they eat at the cafe instead, since it wouldn't be proper for them to be alone together at her house. Seymour didn't want to do anything that might jeopardize Maggie's reputation. He had put on a black jacket and a string tie to make his outfit more appropriate for an evening out. He still wore his Stetson, though, and the gun belt. As Marshal, he had to be armed, even when he was just enjoying a meal with a young lady. He was sure Maggie would understand. Having grown up around here, she knew more about such things than he did. Seymour knocked on the door of the neat little adobe house and then took his hat off, holding it in both hands in front of him. Maggie stood there wearing a nice dark blue dress with tiny yellow flowers on it. She always smiled prettily when she greeted him, but not this time. She gave him an intense look that Seymour, if he hadn't known better, would have sworn was suspicious and maybe even a little angry.
Good evening, Maggie. How are you?
I'm fine. What are you doing here, Seymour?
Why, we're supposed to have dinner together this evening. Have you forgotten? Or do I have the wrong night?
No, we had a dinner engagement, but I assumed that you'd need to cancel it.
Why would I need to do that?
You have visitors in town. Your uncle, and a very attractive young woman.
The, young lady is his secretary, Miss Jemerson. That's all. She and I aren't friends.
That's not the way I heard it. Mr. Delacroix told me that the two of you seemed quite friendly when you walked past the Black Bull with her this afternoon.
Mr. Delacroix was incorrect. Miss Jemerson took my arm, but only because she was a bit nervous about being in a frontier town, especially one with a lawless reputation. I explained to her that there's law and order here now.
Provided by you, the heroic marshal. I'm sure you told her all about that, too.
I never referred to myself as a hero.
Your Miss Jemison probably read about you in the newspapers.
She's not my Miss Jemison. If anything, she's my uncle's Miss Jemison. You believe me, don't you, Maggie?
I suppose so. You've always struck me as a very truthful man, Seymour.
I certainly try to be. Does this mean we can go ahead and have dinner as we planned?
No, I'm sorry. I'm afraid I've worried myself into a headache, and I don't feel like it. But another time, perhaps.
Of course. I hope you're feeling better soon.
I'm sure I shall. Now.
Now that he had promised her there was nothing going on between him and Rebecca, that was what she meant, he thought, as he put his hat on and turned away. Maggie eased the door closed behind him. Seymour started down the walk toward the street. Night had fallen while he was talking to Maggie, and the shadows were thick. But not so thick that he didn't see the indistinct movement nearby, and a sudden gout of flame from the muzzle of a gun.